May it please the court. I'm Samantha Trahan on behalf of MI, the appellant. In 2009, this court gave us its en banc opinion of Grand Isle. In that case, gave us two things to apply in the present case, a rule and a reason, and I hope that we have the opportunity to discuss both today. First, the rule. OXLA, with its adoption of the adjacent states law here in Louisiana, only applies in this case if the focus of the contract between BP and MI is on an OXLA situs. We determine the focus of the contract by looking at the majority of the work performed. Now, it's a great test.
But is it the majority of work performed or contemplated by the contract? Because the problem I have here is I don't see from the contract, putting aside the whole work order discussion, but just the master contract, that it contemplates anything one way or the other. You're relying on what actually happened, the percentages that actually happened, but I don't see Grand Isle as focused on what actually happened. It's what is the focus of the contract as drafted.
I would refer the court to the amendments at the back of the MSA. Now, the MSA between BP and MI is some 200 pages with a lot of detail in it. The amendments to that contract, to the MSA, give you some of those specifics. For example, in Amendment 4, it gives you the locations where work is to be performed. So the back page of that last amendment shows you that MI is going to perform environmental services on a number of vessels with a daily rate and a monthly rate. And
as well as on platforms.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the problem is that the contract contemplates both.
It does.
And it doesn't tell us, well, 80% is going to be on a vessel and 20% on a platform. It just tells us it's going to be on both. So how can we do a focus of contract on just the master contract? Don't we have to look at the scope of the work to be performed under these so-called oral work orders or under something else?
I think you have to look at the overall structure of the MSA. And I think because the test is the majority of the work performed, I think you do have to look to some of the actual work. I don't think the MSA or even contemplated work orders give you the full answer. I think that under this test, which in Grand Isle was a very practical test, they looked at the work that was done. And the work that was done in this case is not just limited to Mr. Hernandez, although that gives rise to the indemnity at issue. But the work that was performed was, in fact, done on vessels and platforms. And by looking at the work and the history between the parties, you can see that when they entered the MSA, they knew where the work was to be performed and that historically more work had been performed on vessels than it had on platforms.
What's your rule and your reason?
The rule is the focus of the contract with looking at the majority of the work performed.
In the past.
In the past
how
and
far
contemplated. I don't know how far in the past. That's the issue Judge Garza brought up in his dissent.
Yes, isn't that why this is not such a practical test? But it's the law of this court, and regardless, we've already fought that battle. Because it's not so practical, because majority of the work, this case illustrates why the test is not as workable as what it was hoped to have been. Isn't that true?
There is some intellectual honesty in saying that this test has some difficulties in its application. I mean, here we
which
have...
Which were pointed out specifically in the dissent.
Yes,
and this, and they've come, it's like this is prophetic of this case.
Okay, but the problem is, in Grand Isle, they did have a footnote that said, you know, we recognize the master contract may not tell us the focus of the contract, and then we have to look at the work orders, and each work order could determine the situs. So that brings us to the work orders. I mean, the problem I have is here, if this contract clearly contemplated a vessel or clearly contemplated a platform, we'd be done. Because it doesn't, I think it contemplates both, then we're required in applying Grand Isle to look to the work orders, which we don't have any written work orders, so now we're to the oral work orders. So how do you respond to that line of analysis?
I would say that if you look at the footnote that requires Davis and Sons, there is conflict then with the majority of the rest of the opinion if you look down to the level of the individual worker at one location doing one job. Because then we've broken the reason behind Grand Isle, which is stability in allocating risk. and giving predictability to contracting partners.
I mean, the problem you have, and this is the tension in Grand Island in all these cases, is you don't want a fortuity where some guy is a vessel worker, but he happens to one day be on a platform for some reason, and that's where he gets injured, and then that's what governs the contractual indemnity question. You have all of this stuff where people are on a vessel to get to a platform, on a platform to get to a vessel, and you want a contract rule that deals with contract, not tort, and not fortuity. So there's no perfect rule. We have the one we have, and the one we have focuses us to the work order when the master contract doesn't answer the question. So does the master contract answer the question? Because you haven't really told me that it has.
I think it does answer the question, Judge.
Okay, tell me how.
I think if you look at the amendments, which gives you the locations where the work is to be performed, you can see the majority of that work is still contemplated on vessels. And all we can do is supplement that with what actually happened.
Can you tell me the record page where it would, because I'm not sure that just because there's five vessels and two platforms, that means the majority's on the vessel, because we don't know how much work's going to be on the vessel versus, but is there that kind of detail? Because then I missed it.
There is not. Not in the MSA. It lists the different locations.
Okay.
But that doesn't give you the amounts. It doesn't. And that's why we look to our affiant, Mr. Tim Armand, who collected all of the data. And we collected 3 years' worth of data because the parties had been engaged in business. And we thought it was important to show what the locations were consistent and that the percentages of work performed were consistent, even before the MSA was entered into, and then for the following year when Mr. Hernandez's injury occurred. And so we can see in now the MSA and the attached amendments are filed under seal, so that's where they are. So there's not a record cite to that. The affidavit with the summary of the different locations is attached in the record excerpts to the back of Mr. Armand's affidavit.
Okay, but you're agreeing that if we were to find these sealed, and they're always hard to come up with, but if we were to find them, they wouldn't give us any percentages or anything. It would just be a list of vessels, a list of platforms.
It is a list of vessels and a list of platforms.
All right, so that's what correct. Do you do with the work order footnote? I mean, what do you do with the fact that this case seems to call out for that footnote?
It does. I think that what you have to do is say, what did the parties contemplate would arise by using a work order? Okay. The work order that's contemplated in the MSA is a basic form that expressly says cannot change the terms of the contract, the MSA. So all the work order is going to do is tell you, I think even the form doesn't even have a location. I think it's a date. It's extraordinarily generic. And so the idea is now, if we apply that footnote and we say that you take the MSA and some work order, why does that work order have to be down to the specific level of Mr. Hernandez doing one job on the Thunder Horse? There is no work order. So if you're going to imagine a work order, fabricate a work order, it doesn't have to be that specific. It can be more in line with a testimony or the affidavit given by MI in this case. That is, MI works in-house with BP. They do the work together. There is no necessity of an individual work order for Mr. Hernandez on the Thunder Horse because they are already working in lockstep. That work order could be as broad as all environmental services in the Gulf of Mexico, wherever BP is going to be working. It could be to work on a certain number of locations in the next 6 months. The fact is, they are working on a day-to-day basis on every project with BP that they are drilling or doing completion wells in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, be that as it may, an order delivered orally, go do this job, is a reference inevitably back to the MSA.
Well, and you see from
but
the...
I have difficulty with that and seeing how you argue that you escaped the specific work order of Davis, and I'm having trouble with that. But your argument is that because of the integrated operating scheme there, that largely for efficiency purposes, that that really doesn't move the focus from the particular specific work order to a more general adding up of workplace assignment.
Yes, That is our argument, that there is nothing in the record to support the idea that BP made a request for Mr. Hernandez to go out and work for any length of time.
But see, the problem with that isn't it that he's not a volunteer. Mm-hmm. His assignments are quite, he's about the business of it. Unless you're going to insist on, in your argument, by some formality of an order that the actual work be pursuant to something committed to writing, then I'd have trouble with the argument. If there were if it had to have a specific work order, we just had to sign the work order, and we're going to deal in that type of formalism, that's one thing. But I don't read the law to insist upon that.
Well, if there has to be,
do you think that's what it requires?
I think that what we have to look at is what work was being done. And I don't think there's any mandate, though, that we have to look down to the level of the individual worker. And I do think that by looking at the broader concept of the work MI was doing for BP, you fit back within the reasoning of the Grand Isle majority.
But wasn't the work that MI was doing for BP work on the Thunder Horse, and that's what Hernandez was part of? He wasn't fortuitously there on his way, or they were evacuating because of a hurricane coming, mm-hmm. or some fortuitous event that led him to the Thunder Horse. He's working on the Thunder Horse pursuant to the master contract, where that's one of the locations. And so I don't understand why that's, you keep saying we don't want to talk about Mr. Hernandez. Well, why don't we talk about Thunder Horse then? That's pretty broad. That's a platform.
It is. But
okay, so why doesn't that end the debate then?
Because you still get down, now we know that the different locations that work is going to be performed. If now we take the focus off of Mr. Hernandez and we put it on the Thunder Horse, well, now we have a certain number of platforms and a certain number of vessels. And now the validity of the indemnity agreement between BP and MI is going to depend simply on where a guy gets hurt. And so if a guy gets hurt on the Thunder Horse, the indemnity agreements would be invalid.
But the master service agreement itself provides that work orders can take the form of, and I'm quoting, specific direction / instruction to M1 to proceed with work or a verbal request, right?
It does, absolutely. It can take any form. However, what is more important, I think, is the party's course of conduct. And the court can consider the party's course of conduct. And I would refer the court to the One Beacon versus Crowley opinion, which came out in 2011, which is a recent case, in which the party's course of conduct was considered in the context of what is their contract. And here we have an MSA that is 200-plus pages long with parties who are familiar with the law in this jurisdiction. They have made an effort for contractual stability and predictability in recognizing where they're going to do work and that they want maritime law to apply, and that we back that up with actual evidence that, in fact, the majority of their work is performed on vessels instead of platforms. Only in this fashion do the parties gain the stability offered by the majority.
But you could have done that through your contract. That's where you're supposed to gain the stability, and you didn't. Your contract is, we're looking for specific provisions, and they're not there.
Right. I mean, there's no.
There's nothing fortuitous about a specific work order. I mean, that really answers your concerns about the lack of predictability and Grand Isle, et cetera.
Well, that's right. If you call someone out to work and they're going to a particular location, you know that's where they're going to work. In this case, because the parties know they're going to be working in multiple locations, they try to make their risk specific, and that is under maritime law, because they're not going to just one location. And they know in advance, which is different from in a lot of the other cases, they know in advance that they're going to be going to different locations, specifically vessels and platforms.
Okay.
Did I answer your question?
As best you could.
Well, the fact is that there isn't a work order, and that's a struggle on the record. It was a struggle for the district court, and here as well.
Well, and the problem is that the master service agreement doesn't say, you know, you're going to work on five vessels, and it was just happenstance that this guy was on the Thunder Horse or whatever, which was, I think, the Grand Isle issue really was trying to deal with. You know, we had a case where some guy had, like, one leg on the platform and one on the boat. You know, that's not a way to decide contract. So that is really what Grand Isle's dealing with. It's not necessarily saying we just always want to enforce the party's indemnity regardless.
I see that I'm out of time.
You can answer.
Okay. But I think what the majority does do is it sets forth the reason for why it's trying to establish a focus of the contract test. It has to come up with something. Mm-hmm. And the focus of the contract gives the parties that certainty. And here, we can only back that up with what it says and then what the parties actually did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. There are two things we know as surely as the sun is going to rise in the east tomorrow. And that is that there was a work order in this case, and we know the terms of the work order in this case, and they were to perform work on the Thunder Horse, which is not maritime work. It's subject to Louisiana law. Now, I am pleased to talk about that great Grand Isle case because the combination of Grand Isle and Davis and Sons is a really interesting question for this court. We know that for the last 22 years, Davis and Sons has been the law of this court, and it has worked well. Even I am a critic of the court in my articles. Judge Davis in Grand Isle cited my article, which was discussed the problems with the contract cases. Problem with the contracts cases was resolved for good or bad in Grand Isle. But the good thing about that was, and the dissent called him out on that, the dissent called out the problem that there is in these master service agreements. And Judge Davis answered that in the master service context. And he did that by saying that we do have to look at the specific work, that specific work order, adopting the great decision from this court 22 years ago by Judge Rubin, Judge Garwood, and Judge Higginbotham, amazing panel, that has stood the test of time, and that case has not been criticized by anyone, including me, in the comments. Even David Robertson, who criticizes everything this court does, he's not criticized Davis and Sons. Now, the point is that that court resolved this issue for us by saying that you don't have to look at all the work under the contract. There was a great argument yesterday in the Supreme Court in the Lozman case, not on this issue, it's on vessel status, and one of this court's precedents is at stake in that between the 11th Circuit and the 5th Circuit. And what one of the amicus briefs in that case said, and it's just, it's not on this issue, but it's just perfect, the words they used in the Marine Bankers amicus. They called the argument jurisdictional hokey-pokey because if you did not have the rule from Davis and Sons adopted, then what Judge Elrod and Judge Garza and the like said in dissent in Grand Isle would be jurisdictional hokey-pokey. That's what we would have. But that was resolved by looking at the specific work under Davis and Sons. So when we look at that specific
so
work, we
it's
don't
all
have...
About.
Pardon? And I was going to do that for you, Judge, but you beat me to it. You turn around.
That's a song in my head.
I know. You turn around. Is it 49%? Is it 51%? And it can change day to day, week to week, month to month. Do you go retro? Do you go forward? How do you do that? You can't. And the only way to do that is to continue to apply the Davis and Sons six factors.
Okay. Let me just ask you to bear in on this contract. This master service agreement has this list of places where work's going to be performed. And I don't remember the number. Let's say it's five vessels and two platforms. Is your position that the five vessel work, we got the indemnity, we're good to go, the two platforms, we don't, it's OCSLA?
Well, let's look at that because that's actually not exactly what this contract does. This contract is an MSA, and it starts right off the bat, and she correctly notes it's in multiple places in here because they sealed part of it. But section one, right off the bat, starts in section one, paragraph four, starts right off the bat saying it is not a contract by itself. It is not. It doesn't provide any work. In the amendments, it doesn't provide work. That's not what it does. It says it's not a contract. It says it begins with, quote, each individual work order. Each individual work order. And then it goes on in Section 3, Paragraph 2.2, and says that BP's not obligated to provide any work, and MI is not obligated to accept any work order. But now here's the question is, how is it that you request a job? How is it? And the MSA is detailed on that. It says in Section 3, Paragraph 2.1, that BP may from time to time request MI carry out certain work as more specifically defined in each job request, and those job requests are defined as work orders. And then after calling each job request a work order, it says in Section 2, Paragraph 1.18, that the written instruction needs to be at a specified work site. A specified work site. But then, as I can't remember which one of you said, it's very vague as to, not vague, but it's not rigorous as to how the contract calls out for work orders. I think it was you, Judge Higginbotham, and it can be in that template. It can be in an email, or it can be in an oral request followed up by a writing.
Okay. Well, does that get us back into, it's just fortuitously the site then? If it's an oral request and they send somebody out there, it somehow gets, it's pursuant to a contract, but it tends to look more like it's because they happen to be out there that day. There's a tension there somehow.
There's always a tension, Judge, and that was pointed out in the dissent. Mm-hmm. But when you focus on the specific work order, then yes, it may involve somebody having transportation or not. Yes, and that is an issue in the dissent. Fortunately, that's not an issue here because the work was on a platform. He was injured on a platform. There are no maritime aspects whatsoever.
Okay, so what was wrong with my question? You haven't wanted to answer it.
I'm on it right now.
Okay, it's
I was going through the MSA. The parties takes a minute to get there, Judge. The parties treated their own documents exactly the way the MSA said. This is, if you look in the record at pages 226 and 342, there are their service tickets. The 226 is better because you can read the language on it better than you can in 342, but here's what it says. It says, all requests for services shall be issued by BP and accepted by MI on this service ticket. And the service ticket, of course, is subject to the terms of the MSA. It says that. And then these service tickets, like the one for the Thunder Horse, which is accepted and signed by the parties here, that says it takes the specific location, it has the specific work, it has Charles Hernandez's assignment on it, it even has BP's purchase order on it.
And which page of the record is this?
That one is 342 okay. of the record, and 226 of the record has the legible language in it, because it's a bad copy on the
other. Okay, so if Mr. Hernandez was on a boat on his way to the Thunder Horse to do this work, and he got injured, would it be your position that the focus of the contract was still the Thunder Horse?
Well, I have to say that under Grand Isle, because that's
exactly
what
it.
Happened
so
in Grand Isle.
What we're still saying is the focus of the contract is the work site, regardless of the injury site. So you
yes.
still have a contract. So why isn't my original question about, look, the MSA contemplates seven sites, some vessels, some platforms, whatever the particular work site is, where the person injured is going or, you know, is supposed to work, that's it. Well, it may not be beautiful, but it fits with Grand Isle.
Well, that's the correct statement, except for the fact that the MSA contemplates work more than in that just amendment. That amendment is just dealing with the pricing for those sites. That's all it does. It still does not guarantee or provide any work for those sites. That still has to come from work orders under its express terms. And the MSA continues and says, it says three times. I wonder why people say things three times in contract when they don't mean it. But Section 1, Paragraph 5, Section 2, Paragraph 3.2d, that says no oral understandings, No oral amendments. You can't have some amorphous deal that you're going to continue to work the way you were doing. No, it requires the specific work orders. And the parties then went and did exactly what they said they were going to do for specific sites. Now, so when you look at it, it's all three of these things come together. The MSA, which requires specific work assignments for specific locations.
Do you think there's any work to be done by this court in explaining if we were to agree with you, or do you think that the district court order takes care of the situation?
Well, you know, the thing is, Judge, this court has a long history of dealing with this exact situation. It has, this is not the first time, and it's not the last time, where the parties have not come up with a templated form work order. And in fact, the leading case where that happened was Grand Isle, because they had an MSA in that case. There was no work order in that case. And so what did the judge do? He went to the work tickets, the same thing as the district judge did in this case. And that's not the only time that's happened. This court in the Wagner case dealt with an oral work order, and it applied the Davison-Sons factors the same way. And it looked to what you had in that case, no work orders. They looked at the oral
cost. The question is, can we simply adopt the reasoning of the district court, or do we need to write further?
You can adopt the language of the district court, because the district courts know that when you read Grand Isle and you read the footnote that Judge Davis did in response to that dissent, because that was necessary. His footnote was necessary to put in there because we don't want jurisdictional hokey pokey in this case. We can't have jurisdictional hokey pokey. We can't have, in this situation, where parties are going into a contract, and most of these MSAs are for the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of Mexico in land. And so the parties' reasonable expectations need to be accounted
for.
Okay,
let me ask you that. What if the Master Service Agreement had said, we hereby contemplate that the vast majority of work will be done on vessels, but recognize there could be a platform or two, and the purpose of this contract is to provide primarily for the vessels, understanding there might be a platform or two. And then the evidence was the 70% or whatever it was. Would that change this analysis? Would we then say, all right, the focus of the contract's, you know, on vessels, so the fortuity, in a sense, that Mr. Hernandez was working on the Thunder Horse, we're going to ignore that, we're going to enforce the indemnity, we're done?
Tragically, not. And the reason for that is, and it was dealt with in Grand Isle.
Judge Elrod was right in the en banc.
No, it was in the en banc. It's been the law since Judge Brown's PLT decision. And that is that the OCSLA addresses that. It is mandatory choice of law. And there's nothing that this court can do outside of going to Congress and getting them to amend the OCSLA that will allow you to do that. If the contract is maritime, then you can do what you want. Maritime law allows that. You can have whatever you want. But if the specific contract that's involved is not maritime, then you can't do that. Now, and that's a great question.
How does that fit with the focus of the contract, then? You're saying the focus of the contract is just a...
Well, unless you want to overrule Davison-Sons and have jurisdictional hokey-pokey, you're bound by that. But here's the answer. Well, go ahead.
I don't see how that has to do with hokey-pokey. I'm asking about the issue of what Grand Isle means. Mm-hmm. Your opponent has said you looked at the contract, the focus of the contract. That is what Grand Isle says. The problem here is that the contract's a little vague. It doesn't really say, hey, it's a vessel contract, whatever. It has kind of everything in there, and these percentages are coming from reality and not from the contract. I'm changing the story a little bit by saying now the contract says our focus is, what if they just say our focus is vessels, but then this guy gets hired to work on the Thunder Horse.
Right. Well, then what you'd have to do, in essence, is you'd have to overrule Davison-Sons. Or, well, that's actually not true. There is an exception that was put out. If the terms of the contract are to the contrary, if you put in the MSA something, that might be an exception to Davison-Sons. But the point is that if you have that, how are you going to do that? And then once again, you look at what happens when that's actually not what happens, when a majority of the work, you still get into jurisdictional hokey pokey, because what happens if they say we think a majority of it's going to be on vessels, but then it turns out it's not? It doesn't work. But there is an answer. There is an answer, and I'll use this to conclude here. And that is that this court gave the parties a basis to create an enforceable contract. They did that 18 years ago, knowing full well that we have Davis and Sons, but that's the Marcell case. The Marcell case. Marcell's at 11 F3rd 563. It's Marcell versus Placid Oil. And there's a way to avoid the LOIA. They could avoid it in this case. All they have to do is go and establish a direct relationship between BP and MI's insurer. Now, that would require a premium. They'd have to do that because in order to avoid the LOIA, you actually have to pay for it. They'd have to pay. They can go and establish that in this MSA. They could have done that. And they could have established an enforceable contract.
Well, this is all about insurance.
Yeah.
As the great mariner of our court, John Brown, preached more than one occasion to the bar and to the bench. That
my mentor.
Give them clear rules because it's all about insurance. And if you've got a workable standard out there and people can apply it in an even, consistently way, then the last thing we want to do is to try to come up with some conceptually pure thing that doesn't, well, never, inevitably going to be difficult in the final application and because of the mirrored factual pattern. But that, to me, that's the ultimate backdrop against which we ought to be reading it.
And the ultimate way to do that is to apply Davis and Sons, which has worked for 22 years. Look at what that work is, that specific work under those six factors. It's either platform work or it's vessel work that does that. And in fact, they can make this enforceable, as I said, knowing that part of it's going to be platform, part of it's going to be maritime. The maritime's going to be good as gold. A Marcell endorsement, and in fact, the industry, they now call it a Marcell endorsement. That's what they now call it. It's called a Marcell endorsement. You can pay specific premiums and make this valid.
I think we can all agree on that.
So the point is, you can have the expectations of the parties done in this case where everything is enforceable. They chose not to do that here. Therefore, we respectfully praise that you affirm the district court in all respects.
Thank you. Ms. Strahan, you have a rebuttal?
Maybe the most important thing to say is that you look to the work order and the MSA unless there's a contrary intent indicated in the documents. And here we have a 200-page MSA with all operative terms that says, while they anticipate the issuance of work orders, those work orders do not amend the contract. They do not change the contract's terms. All they do is provide an indication of where to go.
They don't change it. They, quite the contrary, they're not operative until they've triggered, but the order triggers, and it triggers the master servant agreement in that sense.
That the MSA does say that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. But what we can do is we can attach on the party's course of dealing because this is a unique case. We attach on the party's course of dealing, and you see that there is no regular issuance of work orders. This is a team that works together on any drilling units out in the Gulf of Mexico, predominantly on vessels. And they know this going in. They know this when the MSA is executed because they have a prior a working relationship. And then they continue to work in the same fashion. I think all of that is important. I think if you take out the course of dealing and then you look only to the actual issuance of the work orders, that is a misapplication of Davis and Sons and then the introduction of Davis and Sons through the footnote in Grand Isle. Because, again, this is a sophisticated contract. They are looking for certainty. They don't allow work orders to trump over the terms of the MSAs. They're supposed to exist. They don't in this case. They're supposed to exist, but the parties understood that relationship, this long-time MSA work order relationship and body of case law. So they specifically said work orders do not change this contract. This is a contract applying maritime law predominantly for work to be done on vessels instead of platforms. And they took that step even further. This is outside the context of Davis and Sons. That MSA, it's a few pages, It said that the contractor is going to perform some labor and some contract, but anticipated the parties would execute detailed subsequent contracts. We have a detailed contract originally, the MSA, with an indication that even if work orders are to be issued, they would not change the contractual terms. The MSA contains rates, it contains locations, it contains details down to the level of education that each person that MI is going to supply to BP will have. There's nothing that these parties wanted to leave to chance. And that is where we get into the reasoning of Grand Isle. That was the purpose of it. Mr. Hernandez could have been injured on a vessel and then exacerbated his injury on the Thunder Horse. If we're looking to his injury to trigger the indemnity agreement, what then would be the focus of that contract?
So you're trading one fortuity for another. One's the fortuity of where the accident happens. The other is a fortuity of the way that all of the applicant, is controlled by the parties, at least to the extent that it doesn't happen except by an order of the insured.
That's correct. But if you look at
the uncertainty of the law that renders it difficult to write insurance.
And that uncertainty.
The uncertainty of the application of the where an accident may happen is. That's what you go back to. That makes it difficult to write rules for.
It does. I mean, Mr. Hernandez, in his 3-year history that we provided, worked at 11 different locations.
All right.
You know, and so what the parties want for their own contractual certainty and their own insurance certainty is to pick one body of law, yeah. And that's maritime law, so that no matter where Mr. Hernandez is, no matter where the work is to be performed, so long as they can show that the majority of that work is on vessels, that then they have that certainty, both in their contracting and for insurance purposes.
Well, you make the argument well. That's a familiar one.
The Fifth Circuit has a number of indemnity, insurance, work order, MSA cases. The other argument of
and they're all wonderful.
And they're all wonderful, absolutely. Haven't read them all.
Appreciate the business.
And of course, it also has a number of maritime cases. And the second part of the PLT test is whether or not the work is maritime. The parties have put forward their briefing and the number of cases on maritime law, and then we refer the.
Well, I have to tell you that I always enjoy the maritime bar here because they are consistently the well prepared, and they know the rules and they know the law. But going back to days when you had all those interlocutory appeals, they were here all the time. I mean, they were here just about. So the maritime trial lawyer was a consummate appellate lawyer at the same time. So we see those skills, and they may have been waning a little bit
but not here.
But not.
Not today.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This case is submitted. Court will stand in recess until tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thank you.